He was sentenced to 293 months on both counts of, or each count of being of felon in possession of a firearm, and 120 months on the theft of a firearm count. All counts were to be served concurrently. I would first like to address the issue of whether the district court abused its discretion on the sentencing, the motion for continuance to sentencing hearing. In Knorr, this court stated that, or held that it will give great deference to the rulings of the trial court on these motions to continue sentencing hearings, with the reviewing each case specifically on a case-by-case basis. In Knorr, the defendant had obtained new counsel, sought and obtained a continuance, sought a second continuance, and the district court denied that motion for continuance. On appeal, this court held that the mere possibility of obtaining additional evidence was insufficient and to overcome the deference that it will give to the trial court. This case with Mr. Zambrella is clearly distinguishable. Mr. Zambrella offered a specific reason why he needed a continuance. He needed time to obtain transcripts to clear up a prior conviction, which had huge sentencing impacts on his case. As you know from reading the briefs, Mr. Zambrella was deemed to be an armed career criminal. One of the three convictions which was contested was an Illinois conviction. The government and the defendant offered, Mr. Zambrella offered evidence at the sentencing hearing which created substantial doubt as to the existence of that conviction.
What was that evidence that he produced?
Well, both parties offered what was called a notification of felony conviction from the Cook County Clerk's Office. This document failed to specify what statute he was convicted of, and the issue was whether he was convicted of possession or possession with the intent to distribute. If it was merely possession, he would not have been deemed an armed career criminal. The impact was tremendous. He went from a total offense level of 23 to an total offense level of 33, thereby increasing his sentence, assuming the district court would have sentenced at the higher end of the guideline range in either case of approximately 14 years. Mr. Zambrella had not previously asked for a continuance that had been granted. 1 week before the sentencing hearing, he sought a continuance through standby counsel, which was me. The district court denied that. He went to the sentencing hearing and offered specific basis for this continuance. And considering the huge impact of the sentence, also distinguishing from the Knorr case, the fact that there was some questions as to whether this conviction was legitimate. Mr. Zambrella offered evidence that he had made substantial efforts to obtain from the Cook County court reporters transcripts. And ultimately, after several letters back and forth, they told him, you can't do, you know, we're not going to talk to you anymore, you're a pro se defendant. Well, certainly pro se defendants are not entitled to additional consideration because it's a knowing choice on their part to proceed. This particular issue, in this particular case, he was put it at some disadvantage because they told him we're not going to give you the transcripts. So at the sentencing hearing, he began as a pro se defendant. He allowed counsel, myself, to take over, and we renewed the motion to continue. It was inherently unreasonable not to obtain these transcripts. It was inherently unreasonable for probation and the government before the hearing, considering the discrepancies, not to obtain the transcripts. Therefore, we think the district court clearly abused its discretion in not granting a simple continuance to put this issue to rest. 14-year difference in his sentence. Tremendous impact on this man, and it could have been resolved through a simple continuance, allowing me now as the counsel to obtain the transcript. The second issue we raised before the court is whether the district court abused its discretion in denying Mr. Zambrella's motion for a Franks hearing. Now, what the district court did do in this case, based upon a previous motion by one of Mr. Zambrella's lawyers, and the district court admitted as such at the hearing, conducted a suppression hearing. And the suppression hearings did not address the Franks issue. And that's really the government's contention in its brief, that this was a Franks hearing in disguise. Well, it couldn't have been a Franks hearing in disguise because Mr. Zambrella would not have been entitled to that hearing prior to the suppression hearings because he could not have met the standard. However, after the testimony of an officer, John Mesnarek, at the suppression hearing, he was able to meet the standard. There were material falsehoods contained in the affidavit. Material falsehoods. And once he made the request for a Franks hearing, the district court, at a minimum, should have taken the evidence before it and gone through the Franks procedure, omitted the false information, inserted the omitted information. In this case, it involved a tape of a telephone conversation allegedly made between Mr. Zambrella and another party from the Kankakee County Jail. The tape, or the conversation, neither party identified themselves, and they merely referenced an apartment. They didn't specify an address. Now, the only connection to Zambrella on that tape was an officer. Now, in the affidavit, Officer Mesnarek stated affirmatively, Mr. Zambrella was identified, and he said it was an officer, Joel Whalen. Well, Officer Whalen testified at the suppression hearing he didn't identify Mr. Zambrella. Most likely, Officer Mesnarek mistook or made a mistake between, Randy Whaling, never identified, and that's whose name was in the affidavit. Most likely, Officer Mesnarek made a mistake between Officer Whaling and Officer Whalen, who brought him, was one of the officers who brought him the tape. The problem with Officer Whalen, and this is very important, it was the omission, is that Officer Whalen testified at the suppression hearing. His voice sounded similar, but I couldn't, and he interviewed him for between a half an hour and up to 2 hours, according to his testimony. He said he couldn't identify the voice. So they had no evidence tying Mr. Zambrella to that voice. Yet in the affidavit, it made a broad conclusory statement that Mr. Zambrella stated he had gunned at the address at 125 West 8th Avenue in Gary, Indiana. That just wasn't the case. It was inaccurate. The district court abused its discretion in not, after the preliminary showing was made for Franks, in not going and conducting the Franks analysis. I'll reserve the rest for rebuttal. Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Flynn. Ms. Hennage?
Good morning. Ruth Hennage for the United States of America. I did not handle this case below. The case was handled by AUSA Randall Stewart. We are asking the court to affirm the convictions of Mr. Zambrella and to affirm the court's sentencing. With respect to the district court's denial of the motion for a continuance of the sentencing, we've argued and feel firmly that there was no abuse of discretion. Judge Moody had a very full record at the sentencing hearing in this case. The exhibits that were pertinent to the sentence, the main sentencing issue, the 1990 conviction out of Cook County, which is what triggered the 10-level enhancement for being a career offender, are contained in the appendix. The government submitted at that hearing, pursuant to Judge Moody's request, when the judge realized that there was another document that had been presented by Mr. Zambrella that was not the same document purportedly that the probation office had used to prepare the calculation. The judge said to the government, "You have the exhibits." The government said yes, and the exhibits were admitted into the evidence. When you look at the exhibits submitted by the government, that's the main evidence that Judge Moody had to determine by a preponderance that 1990 conviction was for possession of a controlled substance with intent to distribute. They all worked together.
What does that mean? They all
work together. The crucial, what might be considered to be the crucial document, Your Honor, was the final notification of final felony disposition. And in the government's certified copy from certified from the clerk's office, it did not contain the precise statute for the conviction. The government, however, admitted other records that Judge Moody was able to look at and conclude for himself. that the 1990 conviction was for the more serious offense, which then triggered, it was a predicate act for the enhancement.
What is the more serious offense?
Possession with intent to distribute,
right,
Your Honor,
okay,
as opposed to mere possession.
Mere possession.
The other records admitted, which included the sentencing order, which stated that it was that the sentence was for conviction of possession of a controlled substance with intent to distribute, follows along with the fact that the conviction was to count two. There were other court records that also indicated that the conviction was to count two, not count one, which was the possession charge. So we think that Judge Moody had no trouble whatsoever, especially once he saw the documentation, in concluding.
Your position, I gather, is this notification of felony final disposition was a forgery? Is that what you're telling
me? We argued below, and we've argued in our appeal brief, Your Honor, that there's we would consider it to be a bogus document that Mr. Zambrella submitted. It is what he submitted is a copy of the certified copy that the government had obtained. The document he submitted was not recertified by the clerk. I don't believe the record.
The document you had didn't apparently specify the statute. Is that so? That was inconclusive, I guess.
Well, it was inconclusive, but when you add the other records from the circuit court in Cook County and from the probation department, when you read them all together, they indicate that the conviction was for count two, which was the possession with intent to distribute drugs. Therefore, we're arguing that the judge did not abuse his discretion in any way. He found by a preponderance of the evidence that the 1990 conviction was for the more serious felony. Also, when the motion for the continuance was made, there was no specificity as to exactly what the defendant was going to try to obtain. The judge probably concluded that it had something to do with the transcript of the plea hearing, perhaps, but that was not specific. So we would ask that the court affirm the sentencing.
What's the basis do you have for saying that this one document was falsified? Just as in accord with the copy that you had, is that?
The main reason we feel we can say that, Your Honor, is that the probation office obtained a certified copy from the clerk's office of that document. And it was certified on October 21st of 01. And the government's copy that the probation officer received, I think it was the probation officer, was certified on that date in October, and it does not carry the conviction statute. Mr. Zambrana then claimed with his exhibit, well, yes, I have one that has it in there. But the copy he submitted was the same one that was certified by the clerk's office on October 21st, that did not have the information. And we think that it's safe to argue that the clerk's office did not enter that crucial information, because if the clerk's office had done that, they surely would have certified. Well, they wouldn't have certified on the same document, because it didn't have it in the original certification. Does that answer Your Honor's question?
See what other comments there may be. Thanks.
We obviously don't like to make suggestions that there have been documents bogused up by the defendant, and the statement that was made below went strictly to the defendant, not to his attorney. There also was no supporting documentation that came in with that exhibit, Your Honor, such as a letter from the clerk's office saying, here is a revised copy of the felony disposition sheet.
Do you have copies of all of those documents in this record?
I believe, yes, Your Honor, that they all have been attached in the short appendix.
Okay.
The defendant's exhibits and the main government's exhibits, so they can be compared.
That's fine.
I narrate that in our brief. With respect to the Franks hearing issue, we think that clearly the a judge made the proper decision and that it was not clear error for him to deny the request of the Franks hearing because he really had had a Franks hearing. Counsel's calling it a Franks hearing in disguise. Probably we could have argued below that the preliminary matter had not been shown properly and that the judge did not have to get into the veracity of the affidavit information, but indeed that is what happened on the second day of the suppression hearing. Mr. Zambrella had all sorts of questions for all of the detectives as to what really was the factual basis for the warrant, and we believe that it's clear from the record when you zero in on it that the detective who presented the affidavit had received information from two sources, basically a detective from the Tri-County Auto Theft Division in Illinois. He talked with that person on the phone, and then later the same day he met with one police officer from a municipality in Illinois and another detective from the Tri-County Auto Theft Unit. So he was getting information from a variety of sources, and it seems clear that he had some things perhaps confused, like Walling instead of Wallen. It's not clear from the record what he actually learned from Mr. Wallen, although we would argue that he did not learn from Detective Wallen that he had not made the voice identification. Some more follow-up could have been made, but he didn't do that. But that would be should be declared as just negligence or perhaps sloppiness, but they were doing their best with a difficult situation. The tape came in. It was marked August 21st. There was no reason for the detective who submitted the affidavit to the court to question, you know, what was the real date of the conversation. It's very reasonable to conclude that he thought all this had happened on the 21st. There was no record set that there was anything intentional or that there was any reckless disregard for the truth, and we would ask this court to affirm the conviction.
Thank you, Judge. Mr. Quinn?
Thank you, Judge. I would like to address...
Mr. Quinn, what is the standard of review, did you state?
It's abuse of discretion, Your Honor.
Have you read the United States versus Whitley by this court? The district court's decision denying a Franks hearing motion following an evidentiary hearing is reviewed for clear error.
I apologize if I misstated the standard of review, Your Honor. With regard to the issue on the forgery, it's important to note Mr. Zambrella introduced two documents. One, notification of final felony disposition as identical to the government's document showing that the statute had not been entered into. He introduced several exhibits which were letters in which he attempted to communicate as a pro se defendant with the clerk. That's without question. He also introduced a document which he claimed that he received from the clerk's office showing the statute upon which he'd been convicted. So there was no... the government has made an allegation at sentencing and in its brief that there was somehow forgery involved, yet there's no evidence to that. There hasn't been additional investigations or charges. Mr. Zambrella created... The government's own documents created the issue. And when you take in all the other documents, it still created an issue. And the issue is whether he was convicted of possession or possession with the intent to distribute. And that is a huge sentencing impact. There was enough doubt there where a continuance would have been appropriate. And it was an abuse of discretion, considering it was a 14-year difference in sentencing, not to be totally sure. Again, these were the government's exhibits that created the confusion. With regard to the Franks hearing, the district court cannot be faulted at the suppression hearings for not making a Franks finding because the issue was not before the court. In the court's own words, it was basing the suppression hearings on a motion that had been filed by Mr. Zambrella's prior attorney, which challenged the ability of a state court magistrate to issue this search warrant. It did not raise Franks, and it would have been inappropriate at that time to raise Franks. But when you look at what happened at the suppression hearings, it created a Franks issue, and the defendant correctly requested it. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, Mr. Flynn. Senator, the case